Kelly Kesser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HallieKesserJane.com.
Arguments. He seems to have spent a lot of his adult years arguing, you know, with his band members, with society, with the world, his ex-wife, his record producers. Always an argument? Or it's somebody who just says, I want things right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. He's a guy who wants things right, and the way to get there is often through an argument with a person who's got another view of how things should go. He's running a very, very tight quality control department. So the record that he puts out, it's got to be just right for him.
A guy who wants things right. Yep, that's Tom Petty, which might account for the fact that he is one of the most successful rock musicians of our day. The story behind that success, little known until now, when author and musician Warren Zanes goes behind the scenes of Tom Petty's life in his new biography called What Else? Petty, the Biography. Warren Zanes will be joining me at my table in a moment, along with one of the most successful crime writers ever, the queen of crime, Miss Patricia Cornwell, out with another Scarpetta novel, Depraved Heart. Also on the show, retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant and author, Colonel Dan Hampton, who is here to talk about his latest fabulous book, The Hunter Killers. But first, hi, and welcome to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. I am Hallie Kesser Jane. Today, the Hallie Kesser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HallieKesserJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Hallie Kesser Jane Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and on the iHeart Radio Network. Author and musician Warren Zanes was a member of the Del Fuegos from 1983 to 1989 and is set to release his fourth solo recording. With a PhD in visual and cultural studies from the University of Rochester, he has also been on the faculty at several American universities and is currently teaching at New York University. His writing has appeared in the Oxford American, the Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and more. He has written books about the history of Warner Brothers Records and Dusty Springfield's Dusty in Memphis, as well as co-editing a collection of writings on Jimmy Rogers. He was a consulting producer on Morgan Neville's Oscar-winning documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom, and conducted interviews for Martin Scorsese's George Harrison, Living in the Material World. A former vice president of education and programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, he is currently the executive director of Stephen Van Zandt's Rock and Roll Forever Foundation. Add to his accomplishments the publication of a brand new book, Petty, the Biography, a remarkable look at the life of the lead singer and guitar player of the iconic rock band, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Let's talk.
So let's start with this. It says so much about Tom Petty. This is an unauthorized bio, even though it came out of interviews that he consented to with you. So tell me about that.
Well, when he approached me, I had already done a companion book for the Peter Bogdanovich documentary, Running Down a Dream. I'd done liner notes for the live anthology. So we had a little bit of, you know, familiarity and work experience together. And he said, would you be interested in writing a bio? If you were interested, and of course I was, it would be your book. It wouldn't be co-written, wouldn't be ghostwritten, wouldn't be authorized. I can't tell you what's in, what's out. I just want the chance to read it before publication and to respond to anything that I think begs a response. And that's what he stuck to. And when he said it to me, I had to ask, look, why not authorized? Because it sounded authorized to me. And he said, when I see authorized on a book, I know it's not the truth. And I realized, like, you know what? I think the same way when I see authorized. But this tells you something about how kind of fast his mind works.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's got the southern drawl that makes you think the mind moves at the same pace as the voice. No way. His mind's out ahead of yours. But that's the framework for this process that he established, and he stuck to it.
Listen, Warren, before we even talk about him, really, tell us about you and your association with him and how that led to Petty's biography. An obsession of yours, Mr. Tom Petty? What's going on here?
Well, my relationship with him really starts long before I met him. And I was living in Concord, New Hampshire, 11 years old, and WBCN in Boston was one of the earlier supporters of that first Heartbreakers record. And I heard Breakdown on the radio. And from that time on, not just me, but my brother, my sister, my mother, we always listened to Tom Petty. We got every release. And then when I later formed a band with my brother, the Del Fuegos, we made it our business to find Tom Petty. We wanted to meet this guy, and we made sure it happened. I don't think he had a choice. You know, we were going to sleep on his doorstep if it came to it.
Number one fans.
And he was, you know, he was sympathetic to that. He saw a young rock and roll band who had a hero, and he was kind to us, and he took us out on a 3-month summer tour. He sang a harmony on one of our records, and he was generally just a cool guy to us.
So cool that you got to know him in that respect, too. But you know, Warren, we know the music, but I really do think few of us until this book really knew the man. But I suspect in some ways to know the music will, you know, gives us some insight or clues into who he is. But fair to say that as much as any, his music was a reflection of his life?
This is what I think that the bio does, because I agree with you. There is a lot of him in that music. What do we connect with in music? We connect with the sound of truth. And that's what he's always delivered. And that truth is based on his own life. But what the bio can do is help people who have fallen in love with those songs to kind of connect it more, to really get a deeper sense for the life that got lived that led to those songs.
So, background on Petty, a native son of Florida. Tell us about his childhood and his intro to music. It begins as it does with so many people today, or of that era, really. Elvis.
Yes, in many respects, if you want to study the rock and roll era, you've got no one better than Tom Petty, because he has that moment where he's just, I think he's 10, and he meets Elvis Presley on a movie set in Florida, and that's when he trades his slingshot for a box of 45s. But then he goes on, you know, he experiences Beatles on Ed Sullivan. He forms his bands. Those bands move to California. Next thing you know, he crosses paths with people like Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Johnny Cash, Del Shannon, Roy Orbison. It's an unbelievable arc. So for a writer, I get to, it's a gift, because it gives you this kind of narrative framework, but it's also the story of rock and roll. So that first Elvis encounter just starts the engine.
You know, a lot of kids come from circumstances like he did. You know, Petty, I think you say, was a kid without a lot of promise, a southern it kicker, but he had a dream of something better. What fueled the well that drove his ambition more than others?
Well, he gives a pretty detailed account of the abuse he suffered at his father's hand, and we knew we had to do that. You know, as I said to him, he talked about the abuse, but he hadn't given the details, and that's what books are there to go deeper. But a kid, you know, at 5 years old, his father beats him until he's got welts up and down his body. Now, a five-year-old's trying to make sense of the world, you know, is very much in formation. And the person he's supposed to be able to trust the most you know, his father does this to him. Well, how could it not be that that same kid feels the need to show he's undeserving? That shouldn't be happening to him. He wants to show the world that he's better than the treatment he received. And I not to make it too simple, but I think ambitions often come to kids who go through that. The ones who survive it mentally want to go on to prove to the world that they deserve better.
You know, there are always at least two persons within a performer, the onstage personality and the offstage personality. In Petty's case, how aligned or misaligned are those two people?
Well, when I see him play, you know, for instance, I went to the 5 Beacon shows in New York, you know, every night. And he doesn't look different up there to me than he does when I'm sitting down at his home in Malibu and we're doing an interview. He looks like the same guy. I don't think he's ever been the kind of chameleon type. He's got one character he can play, and that's Tom Petty. So when he goes up there, he's fronting a band. But I think the emotions going into the songs, or else he wouldn't be able to deliver them in the way that would satisfy us. But he's remarkably consistent, remarkably sturdy, given what he's gone through. But he never sells himself as something he's not.
You know, interesting how you characterize what came out of your years of interviews with him. You say he gave you insights and arguments, regrets and lasting ambitions and details of his life on and off the stage. Talk to me first about insights and arguments. Insightful, that I get. Clearly, just listen to his music. Arguments. He seems to have spent a lot of his adult years arguing, you know, with his band members, with society, with the world, his ex-wife, his record producers. Always an argument? Or it's somebody who just says, I want things right?
I think that's exactly it. He's a guy who wants things right, and the way to get there is often through an argument with a person who's got another view of how things should go. He's running a very, very tight quality control department. So the record that he puts out, it's got to be just right for him, and that means that he's got to be aligned in his thinking with a producer. That's not easy to pull off. He's got to be aligned in his thinking with a band. That's not easy to pull off. When it comes to releasing it, he's got to be aligned in his thinking with his record company and his management. That's not easy to pull off. And if you want it exactly like you want it, there's going to be a lot of argument along the way. And then that's how the world began to see him, is as the I won't back down guy. Because he kept showing us that's who he is.
A fascinating character for sure. And here's another aspect you reveal in this book about his heroin addiction. And here's a question for you. For a smart guy, how stupid could he get to get hooked on heroin?
He would be the first to say, I think, very stupid. But it's, you know, we do stupid things if the pain gets to be enough. You know, and I don't think he would ever want to be let off the hook for the choice that he made. You know, I think he's adamant about that. But he was kind of pinned down to the mat at that point in life. And that's when, you know, that's when he made this very bad decision. But, you know, he had ended a marriage of almost 20 years. One of his kids was old enough for college. The other still, you know, mid-teens. It became out of control pretty quickly. He couldn't help the people he loved the most. His band was, you know, really at a place where it seemed like, how long is this going to last? The tension with Stan Lynch was pretty intense. I think that life slowed just long enough for all that childhood abuse to kind of come forward, and the album cycle kept him from addressing the fact that he had depression. All this stuff kind of comes together and just slams him. And he's dealing with a level of pain that he doesn't know what to do. And he's a rock and roller. He's in a world where he knows what's out there for people who want to kill pain.
I want people to know that
a bad choice.
Bad choice. I want people to know how many people you got to talk about him besides him, of course, which is so delicious in this book. What was your favorite person that you got to, and the most revelation that you got out of somebody that just startled you?
Well, it would be hard to say my favorite, because he's surrounded by, you know, the Heartbreakers alone are a deeply engaging bunch. Stevie Nicks is a fantastic interview, and in part because she loves Tom so much. And it just, and she was unguarded. You know, I think the word came down that people could be unguarded, and so they were. So she had a beautiful way of being unguarded. Stan Lynch was an incredible interview because he has not talked a lot about the Heartbreakers, and here's a guy who was, you know, for the first half of that story, he was the drummer, crucial member of that band, fired, and he talked about it. That was amazing, and I wouldn't want to imagine the book without his presence. Jackson Browne was great, in part because he was willing to just, you know, show what a fan of Tom Petty he is and show how much he admires Tom as a songwriter. You know, that was beautiful. The producers, Jimmy Iovine, you know, an incredible interview, just full of fire. And when he starts talking about making the damn the Torpedoes and Hard Promises, it's like it happened yesterday. Now, these people, they did a lot to make records. So when you get them talking,
they got a lot
like
to say.
Present tense, you know.
There you go. Regrets, does he have a few?
Well, we already talked about heroin. I think that's a big regret. I think he, you know, he wanted things to work. He wanted his band to stay together and work. He wanted his marriage to stay together and work. And I think part of his regret is that he could have let some things go earlier. You know, he was trying so hard to keep them together as if that was just an unequivocal good. And he came to see sometimes keeping the thing together is not the best choice. Sometimes you let things go in a timely fashion. You know, but that's, you know, I learned about my own marriage in the process of this book. I got divorced, you know, so I was in a marriage that I was desperately trying to keep together. And I learned from Tom Petty that doesn't, just trying to keep something together isn't simply the best thing to do. Sometimes you got to let it break. And, you know, he was so open in talking about this stuff that, from his regrets, I learned something about my own life.
30 seconds. Demons still driving him, or you can't keep a good man down?
Well, I think you can't make a good record maker and songwriter down. You know, I think Tom Petty might make his best record 2 years from now. You know, he's just, he's going to be that forever. That's who he is. And he's made such good stuff. The best may be yet to come. And he's 65. That's incredible.
I've been speaking with Warren Zanes, author of Petty, the Biography, by way of Henry Holton Company. Petty, the Biography, is available at fine bookstores everywhere. It's been 25 years. That's right. I said 25 years since bestselling author Patricia Cornwell launched the hugely popular Dr. K. Scarpetta series and a national obsession with forensic research. Yep, before there was CSI, NCIS, and all the other copycats, there was Cornwell and Scarpetta. 25 years since her first book, Postmortem, was rejected by numerous publishers because no one wanted to read about a woman who cuts people open. But how wrong were they? The morgue is taboo no more, and now, yep, 25 years later, 29 New York Times bestsellers under her belt, Patricia Cornwell is back with a new captivating Scarpetta thriller, Depraved Heart, with all the shocking twists, high-wire tension, and cutting-edge forensic details that Cornwell is famous for, proving yet again why she's the world's number one best-selling crime writer. Let's talk.
So listen, 25 years, you and Dr. K. Scarpetta together for all those years, a lot of water under that bridge, too, for the two of you. So tell me this, how is living with K., how has it changed your life?
Oh, living with K. has completely changed my life. And, you know, this is a very interesting thing that when I started out as a writer, if you had told me that when you create characters, they also create you, I would have thought that was a very silly thing to say. But it turns out to be true, because if you develop series characters, and Scarpetta most of all, because, and she's actually, you know, we're celebrating her 25th birthday, but the fact is, even several years before the first book came out, you know, I was playing around with the notion of this character and trying to put her in stories and trying to figure out how to do all this. So she's been around for a while, but when you are constantly focused on certain characters, you have to do things to learn about them. And in the process of doing those things, it changes you. So to give you some very graphic example, when you see thousands of autopsies and become a volunteer police officer and put on a uniform and go to crime scenes and do all these things that I began to do in the early days, when you learn to fly helicopters and get your pilot's license or ride motorcycles or become a scuba diver, all so you can show these characters doing these things, of course that changes you. And I can honestly say that I think spending a quarter of a century with my imaginary friends, particularly Scarpetta, have, I think, made me a better person. I'm really grateful for it.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Listen to me. This is the figure that I just found. I don't know if this is the latest, but this is what I found. 100 million books. You have
yes,
sold?
That's what it was as of several years ago. I don't know what it is now, but it's at least 100 million books. And that from somebody who, when my first one finally got accepted post-mortem, and that was 1989, it came out in 1990. At that time, the first printing of post-mortem was 6,000 copies. And I got paid $6,000, and there was no budget for doing anything. So you would have, if you had told me then that this would happen, I'm really glad I didn't know it. I think it would have scared me to death.
Can you
I would have run for the hills.
I know I would have. Can you take that in, though? Can that figure even get into your body? I mean, that's wild to me.
No, here's why I can't even begin to wrap my mind around that. You know, I've been to warehouses where, you know, you have to do massive stock signings. So I know what it looks like to see thousands of books stacked up. I can't begin to imagine 100 million. I mean, I'm sure you could almost go around the planet with that. I don't know what you do with it, but and the fun thing is for all those books you've sold, you don't know how many other people have actually read
exactly
those same books. And so it's really quite an honor to think that so many people may have read even one Scarpetta story. It's really, I've been incredibly fortunate.
Really. And that's after having a really tough childhood, a father who abandoned you when you were, what, 5, and a mom who suffered from depression.
Yeah.
You end up in foster care. I understand foster care. I raised a foster care child. It's going
well,
up.
Well, I bet
trip.
You raised yours better than that foster person raised me.
So I understand. So no. I understand. But
so,
right? I
yeah,
get that.
I think, I think one of the things that's really remarkable when you talk about someone's childhood, particularly an artist, I think if you have the hardships, you don't wish for them, and you would never wish for them for anybody else, and you wouldn't do it to somebody. But what it does do is if you're really uncomfortable as a little kid, you try to find ways to soothe yourself, and I did it through my imagination. The world was not a very happy place for me, so I created things that were better than what I was living in. And I became really good at a very young age of creating imaginary friends and imaginary situations. And I literally would go out on my bicycle, and I was on missions. I was a spy. I was like a little Nancy Drew. You know, if there was a problem in the neighborhood, in my imagination, I was going to go take care of it. And I'd go riding around and telling myself stories and writing stories and creating little books. And so what a gift. So, yes, it wasn't fun, and I was lonely, and I was very sad a lot as a little kid, but what a gift I was given to learn how to do this.
Exactly, and here's the thing that I want to ask you about that, though. You know, so many other kids who might have gone through that, and I know even after you had tough times as a result, but you got yourself together, and look what you've built, and I want to know why you think you were able to not take to the bed like another bunch of kids might have done and go out there and make it. Tell me why. Do you know?
Well, I think the most important reason why is that I had other people And it only takes one. Don't ever forget, because now you were talking a minute ago about being a foster parent, and that's a really good example that you take one person who intercedes with, shall we say, someone who's been abandoned or has suffered tremendous loss and is not being taken care of. That one person can change a life and change the world. And I had somebody like that. I was very fortunate because when I turned 19 and I dropped out of school, I had an eating disorder, I was a mess and a very, very sad, unhappy person and scared person. And this, I had the most amazing miracle happen. I mean, Ruth Graham, who was Billy Graham's wife, has nothing to do with religion. Forget the religion part of it. But she was this major, beautiful celebrity woman in our town. And everybody even wanted to have a minute with this woman, much less be her friend. And I'd admired her from afar, you know, my whole childhood. And she swooped in and became my mentor.
Lucky
she
you.
And that changed my life, because what it did for me is I thought must be something worthwhile about me that a woman as important as Ruth Graham would care about me. Why would she? I'm just a little neighborhood riffraff, you know? So that really is what made the difference. And, you know, there's a little bit of Ruth in Scarpetta. That would shock people. You'd never think of that with someone married to Billy Graham, but this was a feisty, beautiful woman who was absolutely afraid of nothing, and if there was something going on, she would step right in and change the day. And of course, my first book was a biography of her.
Let's get to books.
Sorry?
I want to get to books. They're going to kill me if I don't get it. The depraved heart. We got to get to books. I love this book. But you want to finish what you were saying? Go. Tell me.
No, I'm only saying that when you talk about, I couldn't have written Depraved Heart had I not grown up the way I did. I mean, all of this has made me who I am.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I love this title, by the way, Depraved Heart. So, great word, depraved. Talk to me. Where did this story come from and why now?
Well, depraved heart, as you probably know, is a legal term, and what it refers to is an absolute wanton disregard of human life. And so it's referring to the worst of the worst in terms of a predator who not only has no respect for human life, but loves to toy with it and cause tremendous upset and suffering, just mayhem. And so this book opens, the new Scarpetta book opens with our character, our hero, Scarpetta, is at a crime scene. It's an 18th century mansion on the border of the Harvard campus, and there's a dead woman on the floor, blood everywhere, supposedly an accident. And she's looking at it thinking, this is no accident. And just as this is going on, something lands on her phone, an alert tone, and a surveillance video has been sent to her that has to do with her beloved niece, Lucy, who's also quite a handful, as any of the fans of the series knows. So this is the beginning of an unbelievable adventure where Scarpetta is literally almost having her puppet strings pulled by an external force. And it's going to be it's a really spooky, scary book, a real psychological thriller that sets it slightly apart from some of my earlier Scarpetta books. You have all the technology, the forensic science, forensic medicine in this book, just like you always do. But it's also really, it's meant to be a good Halloween scare.
Do you have fun with this one? How does this one rack on all your books?
I did have fun with this one for a very decided reason. I decided to create a scene, which is this spooky, spooky old house, and to make us live in it. The entire book, because there's so much that has to do with this house, it becomes a character. And you're supposed to start saying, about page 10, Scarpetta, for God's sake, get out of there now while the getting's good.
Love it. You know, you've won more than your fair share of awards, lady. I mean, oh my God, you've racked up just about everyone that there is to get. There are critics, though. There are always critics. I mean, what would this world
sure.
be without critics? And they come at you, and queen of the airport novel. I got to tell you what, I happen to think you're a damn good writer. You know, the two things to write, storytelling. There's storytelling and there's writing. And I think you do both damn well. There's a reason why all these people are reading you. What do you say to those idiots out there who say queen of the airport novel?
I've had a lot. I mean, you know what it is. It's just very competitive, and you know, people like to throw stones at anybody that's out there and has had a successful, you know, whether it's a series of novels or television shows or movies or whatever it is. And so I try to ignore it, but yeah, it's no fun to hear things like that. And no, to call my books airport novels is absolutely ridiculous.
Absurd.
I don't sit around and write romances. You know, I mean, I would say to the people that say that, then why don't you go spend a day in the morgue? You go to crime scenes, you fly helicopters, you scuba dive the Bermuda Triangle, and then come back to me and tell me that I'm doing something trivial.
I've been speaking with best-selling author, the Queen of Crime, Patricia Cornwell. 25 years writing the Scarpetta series, out with her latest, Depraved Heart, by way of William Morrow. For more information about Patricia Cornwell, visit her website at patriciacornwell.com, on Twitter at 1pcornwell, and on Facebook at Patricia Cornwell. Retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dan Hampton flew 151 combat missions during his 20 years in the United States Air Force. For his service in the Iraq War, Kosovo conflict, and First Gulf War, Colonel Hampton received 4 distinguished flying crosses with valor, a Purple Heart, 8 air medals with valor, 5 meritorious service medals, and numerous other citations. He is a graduate of the elite United States Air Force Fighter Weapons School, United States Navy Top Gun School, and United States Air Force Special Operations School. Hampton was named his squadron's Instructor Pilot of the Year 6 times and pioneered air combat tactics that are now standard. A frequent guest analyst on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, discussing foreign affairs, military aviation, and intelligence issues, the graduate of Texas A&M University has published numerous articles. He has published in Aviation History, the Journal of Electronic Defense, Air Force Magazine, Vietnam Magazine, and Air Power Magazine, and written several classified tactical works. He is the author of the national bestsellers Viper Pilot and Lords of the Sky. In his latest book, The Hunter Killers, he recounts the extraordinary story of the first Wild Weasels, the band of maverick aviators who flew the most dangerous missions of the Vietnam War. Let's talk.
So, Dan, darling, it's always so nice to have you here on the show with me, especially when you return with a book and a story as compelling as told in this really terrific, I have to tell you, I love this book, The Hunter Killers. I do. So this is really some story. And let me just say that the way you wrote it is also something else. This is a little bit of a departure for you. This was, reads like a novel.
Well, I was fortunate in that, obviously, I've been a pilot, too. So, I know what it's like to fly a jet and get shot at. But I'd never flown these airplanes. But I was fortunate also in that these guys that actually did fly it, these missions, a lot of them are still here. And I was able to talk to them, and they were able to, you know, help me with the chapters and read it and, brief it and everything else. So
you're being modest. This is your baby.
Well,
you did a beautiful job and own it. So let me, before we even go into all that, I want to just set it up, because for people who don't know this story that we're getting into, it's Vietnam. It's 1965, July 24th. The U.S. Air Force F-4 Phantom jet is suddenly blown from the sky by a mysterious and lethal weapon, a Soviet SA-2 surface-to-air missile, otherwise known as SAM. Launched by Russian, in quotes, advisors to North Vietnam. And 3 days later, right, 6 F-105 Thunder Chiefs were brought down trying to avenge the Phantom. And it only got worse after that, right?
Well, yeah, and that shootdown, that F-4 shootdown was 50 years ago today.
Wow.
Yep.
Catch timing.
And the Spring Hai raid that you're talking about was 3 days later. And that's a pretty critical 3 days. The politicians in Washington couldn't make up their minds what to do. And then when they did decide to let these guys go in and wipe out the SAM sites, Lyndon Johnson publicized it. He went on TV to give everybody warning that they were coming because he was afraid we'd kill some Soviet advisors. So these guys were basically ambushed. And, yeah, they lost six out of 46 F-105s. Not good at all.
Not good at all. Another part to it was that they actually knew these things were being built and kept quiet about it for a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was obvious in all through the beginning part of 1965 that these things were there. And Johnson and McNamara wouldn't let the military go take them out. They were more worried about killing Soviet military advisors than they were about losing our own guys, which is just appalling. It's almost criminal behavior.
Absolutely, no questions. So now they're Johnny-come-latelys, and they decide that they're going to set up this top-secret program called Wild Weasel, right?
What happened is, after the Spring Hai raid,
the Pentagon basically put its foot down and said something has to be done. And Johnson and McNamara were pretty appalled by the results of that raid, so they gave permission for everything to go ahead. And so within 6 months, which is very, very quick for the military, a bunch of equipment had been pulled out of bomber aircraft, self-protection equipment and some other things, detection equipment, because they were the only ones that had it, and they'd been adapted to a fighter jet, an F-100, and they'd found a group of guys crazy enough to go over and use these aircraft and this modified equipment to hunt down the SAMs, and those guys were the Wild Weasels.
So let's talk about these airmen involved in this. Maverick fighter pilots and electronic warfare officers volunteered, right, to fly.
Right.
This is like, tell me what they're doing. They're like putting themselves out there as bait.
Well, you know, fighter guys are all crazy anyway, a little bit.
You
so
think?
That's no big deal. I was surprised that the electronic warfare officers volunteered as emphatically as they did, because those guys came out of the bomber community. They'd never seen a fighter before. They'd never seen a fighter pilot. You know, they're two very, even though they're in the same Air Force, they're two very different types of people, you would think, but apparently not, because they got along very well and they figured out, you know, how to do this very well. And as for being bait, yeah, it's a common assessment of this, but, you know, I was a weasel too, and I'll tell you that we never thought of ourselves that way. We're the dangerous ones. We're the ones that are going out and doing the hunting and killing. You know, we're not bait, and these guys didn't look at themselves like that either. They were the ones that, hence the name of the book, we're going to go out and do the hunting and the killing.
That fascinates me. Let's talk about you Wild Weasel characters, and you are characters. You're not going to tell me you're not. I mean, really, supremely confident or egomaniacal? Talk
no,
to me.
No, you know, and that's a common misconception. People, and I don't mean you. I mean mostly people that envy that sort of person mistake it for arrogance, and it's not. It's what it is an awful lot of training, years and years of it, and then supreme confidence that in fact you're better than anything you're going to face, because if you don't think you are, then you don't have much of a chance at all of coming back. So you have to believe it, and you have to be able to back it up, but I mean you have to believe it. So it often gets mistaken for, you know, egomaniacal tendencies, but it's really not.
Hey, so this training, and I think this is fascinating to me, they can do that. They can get you so on automatic pilot, almost to speak, and your response is so fast, so incredibly swift to whatever's coming at you. Is that what the training is? I always wondered about that.
Well, to some degree, you know, what you're saying is quite correct, today anyway. But I have to point out that when these guys were doing this, they were the first ones. So they were basically making it up as they went along, and they didn't have the benefit, like I did, of 25 years worth of other people's, you know, fights and mistakes and lessons that they'd learned the hard way. I had all that by the time I went into combat the first time in the Gulf War. These guys didn't. So, again, they were asked to do something. They weren't told what it was, and they were told they wouldn't have much of a chance of coming back, and they weren't given real great tools to do it, and they did it anyway. So to me, that makes them very, very special.
I don't remember if I asked you this last time you were on the show with your other book, but I want to ask you this now. Patriotism, is that something that's ingrained in all of you guys who get involved in this? Because I don't think the whole of America has the same sense of patriotism that some do, or that we all used to. Nationalism is kind of like, not like what it was. Talk to me about that. Does that apply here?
Well, you know, to some degree, it does. Remember that anybody that flies, any military pilot, is an officer. So they're not drafted, okay? And we don't have a draft anymore anyway. So they're all volunteers, okay? And these are guys that have all been through college. They could all be doing something else, but yet they choose to do this. And you know, we're not alone. There are other professions that are equally loony that you kind of shake your head and say, why would they do that? Patriotism certainly has something to do with it. I think over time it gets tempered with, you know, a little bit of cynicism and experience, at least in my case. But these guys certainly believed in what they were doing. And, you know, not to wave the flag too much, a lot of it is being able to face that sort of challenge and live through it, because if and when you do that, you don't have anything else to prove to anybody the rest of your life, and that's kind of a nice place to be at, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, for sure. I'm going to sidebar, because you brought it up, the draft. How do you feel about the fact that there isn't a draft anymore?
I personally, I think most of the guys in Vietnam who served alongside of draftees feel this way. You don't want somebody next to you who doesn't want to be there or believe in it. So if you have to force people to fight, be it the draft or conscription, you know, what kind of soldier are you going to get? And there were some good ones, don't get me wrong, but I mean, combat is difficult enough without having to worry about the quality of the guy next to you. And I wouldn't want to do it. And again, I wouldn't have to, because pilots being officers aren't drafted. So that was never a factor for me.
All right. Interesting. Let's go back to the mission for a second. And the rate of loss of pilots and capture was extraordinarily high back then, correct?
Yeah, and remember, it's not just pilots in this case. The guys in the back seat,
right,
the electronic warfare officers, the original weasels could not have functioned without them. By the time I came along, it was all single seat, but these guys had to work together to make this happen. So they're right in there with them.
Things went bad, but then things turned around. Great characters that you allude to and talk about in this book. Just fabulous, fabulous, fabulous men.
Well, and they're all real, too. That's what makes
it
even better.
I mean, right? I mean, like, you know, yeah. I wanted to meet each and every one of them and know each and when every one of them. I'm just about Captain Al Lamb and then, of course, Jack Donovan. I mean, talk to us a little bit about these guys. Well, do they even make people like this, except for you? Except for you,
Oh,
Dan.
Al Lamb is great. I was up at his house a couple times when I was writing the book, and then I was back on the East Coast, I think in April or May, and spent a couple weeks out with him and his wife, and he's a great guy, and he's indicative of that type of person, and they're still around today. The problem is the people haven't changed. The Air Force has changed. The Air Force is a lot more politically correct and anal retentive than it ever was in those guys' days. So anyway, it's a different Air Force, but the basic guy that does this hasn't changed. Al Lamb, Stan Goldstein, he's a hoot. He's one of the EWOs that really helped me out with this. Ed Rock, guy who started flying fighters, you know, around the Korean War, and then ended up with a couple tours in Vietnam. Leo Thorsness, you know, he won the Medal of Honor later on. These guys are real. These guys are true heroes, and that word gets overused and used in the wrong cases a lot these days. But that's another reason for reading this book, is we don't really have a whole lot of true heroes these days, and sometimes it's good to look to the past a bit to get inspired. So I hope people will.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. I think we do have some heroes today. You're one of them.
And no, I would never say that.
Well, I'm saying it for you, okay? And the thing is, I think that what happens is, I think we're so jaded today, we're not even clear what a hero is. That's
right.
All.
Well, it's not Caitlyn Jenner and her cat. So.
Exactly. Well, you said that.
Yeah.
You said that. So listen, this is an important story for a lot of reasons, okay? And I love the fact that you went back and you told a story that hasn't really been told. And it's history. So it's important to an historical sense. But let's bring it forward to today. You know, the Hunter Killer proves how resourceful our Air Force can be. But how effective? So listen to where I'm going with this. It appears that President Obama seems to think that in fighting ISIS, whatever acronym you're going to use these days, that he wants to call these lunatics, just that's what they are, so let him have his ISIS, whatever, but that the Air Force can accomplish the job alone. Can the Air Force accomplish the job alone?
No, and the fact that he thinks so is yet one more piece of proof that he is the amateur that we've all seen, you know, come out. The fact that he's an amateur isn't unexpected. The fact that he has surrounded himself with other amateurs that won't tell him the truth, well, that's kind of shameful. And the real shame in all this, and it isn't just him. Clinton and even Bush did it too. They would risk our American fighting folks for political reasons, purely political reasons. And that's all he's been doing with air power, is stalling. You cannot win a war from the air. unless you drop a nuclear bomb on somebody. But you can't win a war from the air. It's a nice way to look busy, to look like you're doing stuff, and gives you a lot of good PR footage, you know, on TV. But you can't win it from the air. You can lose a war if you don't control the air, but you can't win it solely from the air. So he's just biding time. I don't think he really knows what to do. And in the meantime, you know, guys are risking their lives every day. So it's a shame.
It is a shame. Let's go back to Vietnam in this sense, because this is a question I would love to hear your expertise on. And I'm wondering if you believe that the agony of that defeat isn't still diminishing America's resolve and our commander-in-chief, in this particular commander-in-chief resolve. Do you think that still plays a part?
Well, I don't think anybody who fought in it thinks we were defeated. I think that they...
Right.
They and they're correct. They were not allowed to win, which is very true. That was a war that did not have to be fought. I've never met anybody who fought in that war who thought that it had to happen, which surprised me. But the more I learned about it, the more I realized they were correct. And there were several instances throughout the war when we could have extricated ourselves. And in fact, the other side was quite willing to do so. So I think Vietnam spelled the very first very big chasm between public belief and their leaders, because, you know, obviously before that, especially in World War II, the whole country was at war. It wasn't just the military and the government. I think in Vietnam, the country was not at war. The political leaders, and then by default the military, was at war, but not the people. And that started to cause a huge rift that we still see today, because nobody really trusts the government anymore, do they?
No, I really don't think that they do. I mean, there was a big mistake made when the guys came back from Vietnam, but blaming, you know, the warriors and not the commanders.
And that's something that I have seen over and over that I think has finally been healed.
Yeah.
People that were pretty big anti-war protesters, you know, have said to me that they still don't believe in the war, but they went about it the wrong way. And I think most people realize if you want to protest the war, that's fine, but put the blame where it belongs, not with the people who have to fight it.
Absolutely. I started this talking about the fact that Russia, quote unquote, was the bad guy. Russia still the bad guy? Still a bad guy?
Oh, absolutely. They always have been, and they always will be. They are definitely worth watching, because they have territorial ambitions beyond their own borders. China may, but they're more concerned with the Pacific Rim and their own ballpark. Russia, on the other hand, being Russia, would expand if they could. And they've always been a danger. So, yeah, you know, we need to stay vigilant. It's not to say we need to look for a fight or get paranoid, but if we think the world's one big happy family ready for a group hug, we've still got a ways to go.
I've been speaking with New York Times bestselling author, one of the most decorated and legendary pilots in Air Force history, Dan Hampton. His latest book, The Hunter Killers, by way of William Morrow. For more information on Dan Hampton and his work, visit his website at danhampton.org. Find him on Facebook at Dan Hampton Author. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieCancerJane.com.